Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Get ready, because today we are diving into something truly incredible.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that your brain isn't fixed, not like a piece of hardware you can't change.
Right.
It's actually dynamic. It's constantly adapting. We are talking about neuroplasticity.
That's the one.
And thinking about plasticity, you know, our sources for this dive use a really good analogy.
Yeah.
Like clay, something easily shaped or molded.
Yeah.
That gives you a great picture.
Yeah,
right?
It's very intuitive.
So neuroplasticity is that amazing ability of your brain's wiring the actual connections, how they work,
yeah.
to be reshaped by experiences, new information, stimulation.
Even damage, unfortunately.
Right, even damage.
And the more, let's say, formal definition captures that well, it's the capacity of neurons, neural networks, to change connections and change behavior.
Okay.
And this happens in response to... well, almost everything. Normal development, learning, sensory input, like you said, injury, dysfunction. It's literally the brain reorganizing itself.
And we're here because of you, our listener. You shared this great stack of articles and research all about this. Really fascinating stuff.
It's a fantastic topic.
So our mission today, unpack what these sources tell us.
Yeah.
How does this adaptation actually happen? Why does it matter so much? For learning, for recovery.
Everything, really.
And what surprising examples do they give? Okay, let's dive deep into this.
All right, so for a long time, the view in neuroscience was, well, pretty rigid.
How so?
The idea was basically once you hit adulthood, your nervous system, it was set, locked in.
Like development just stopped.
Pretty much. And if damage happened after that critical period, it was often seen as, well, permanent.
Yeah.
Irrecoverable.
That sounds incredibly bleak.
It did. But what the sources today make really clear is that the modern understanding is totally different and much more hopeful, actually.
Okay.
Neuroplasticity is ongoing. It continues your whole life.
Yeah.
Your brain isn't static at all. It's continually changing. It allows for new learning, forming new habits, and, yeah, even letting parts of the brain compensate when other areas get damaged.
So that's the core good news, then, this lifelong ability to adapt, learn, recover.
Absolutely. That's the positive side. But, and this is important, the sources really stress this. It's not magic.
Right. Not a cure-all.
Exactly. That's maybe the realistic news or the bad news, if you prefer. These capabilities, they vary a lot, depending on the person, the kind of change needed.
And age, I imagine.
And often, yes, they do tend to weaken somewhat with age. Plus, some brain areas are just more plastic than others. And severe damage. It might not be fully overcome.
Got it. So powerful, definitely, but there are nuances, limitations.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts. How does the brain actually pull this off? The sources mention several key ways.
They do. And when we talk about the brain changing, often we're talking about changes right down to the synapse.
The connection points between neurons.
Exactly, that tiny junction. And one really fundamental way this happens, described to the sources, is long-term potentiation. LTP.
LTP.
Good LTP way. Is basically strengthening a synaptic connection. So if one neuron keeps stimulating another one repeatedly, that connection gets stronger, more efficient, more responsive. The sources mention experiments showing a pathway just responding much more robustly after it's been stimulated again and again.
Like if you practice playing guitar, the brain pathways for that get stronger. Is that the idea?
That's a perfect analogy.
Well,
LTP is seen as a really key mechanism for that kind of learning. It's often considered the basis for how we form memories.
The whole neurons that fire together, wire together thing.
That's exactly. That's the neural signature.
Okay, so that's strengthening. What else?
Well, there's the flip side. Long-term depression, or LTD.
Depression. So weakening.
Precisely. It's the opposite. Repeated stimulation under different patterns can actually make a synaptic connection weaker.
Why would the brain want to do that?
It's just as important. It lets the brain prune away connections that aren't relevant anymore or weaken associations that are no longer useful. It's like the brain cleaning house.
Yeah.
Deciding, okay, maybe we don't need this link to be quite so strong.
So the brain is constantly editing itself, making some connections louder, some quieter.
That's a really good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Synaptic strengthening is just the general term for anything increasing synapse effectiveness. With LTP as a star example.
Okay.
And building on that editing idea, there's another crucial process, synaptic pruning.
Pruning. Like in the garden?
Exactly like gardening. The sources use that analogy too. Yeah. The brain literally trims away the synaptic branches that aren't being used.
It gets rid of connections.
It does. And it's a massive process, especially early on.
Yeah.
The sources outline a kind of timeline.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, between birth and about age two, the brain forms this huge excess of synapses. Just tons of them.
Aww.
Then from around 2 to 10 years old, there's this period of really rapid pruning, getting rid of the unused ones. Streamlining
the network.
Right. And this keeps going, though maybe slower, through adolescence and into your late 20s. Refining the networks, especially in areas like the prefrontal cortex, the part for planning and complex thought, it's all about efficiency. Keep what's active, let go of what's not.
That's wild. So development isn't just adding stuff, it's actively taking away, refining.
Exactly. It's refinement.
Yeah.
And here's where it gets, well, really interesting, though. The sources are very careful here. They note this is ongoing research. These are theories, not established direct causes.
Okay. Important caveat.
Very important. They mentioned that unusual levels of pruning, either too much or too little, might be associated with certain complex conditions.
Like what?
For example, some theories link schizophrenia to potential overpruning. Maybe too many connections get trimmed. Possibly due to genetic factors, especially during that intense pruning phase in adolescence when symptoms often appear.
Huh.
Some research notes fewer synapses overall in some areas, but interestingly, maybe more of those little dendritic spikes in one part of the hippocampus. It's complex.
Okay, and the opposite, underpruning.
Right. Some research suggests a possible link between autism and underpruning, meaning maybe more connections are kept than typical, leading to different connectivity patterns. Though how this looks can vary, depending on the brain region or developmental stage.
Interesting.
And savant syndrome or savant abilities, some researchers think that might also be associated with underpruning, which could help explain why it's seen more often in people with autism.
So it's not just if pruning happens, but the balance, getting it just right, seems potentially critical for typical development. Too much or too little trimming might be involved in these conditions.
That's the kind of hypothesis being explored, yes.
Yeah.
It's really complex biology.
Definitely.
Okay, another way the brain adapts, especially after injury, is called denervation supersensitivity.
Denervation,
yeah.
Supersensitivity, okay.
Yeah. If a neuron loses input, say the neuron talking to it gets damaged, the receiving neuron can become extra sensitive to any signals it does still get.
How does it do that?
Often by increasing the number of receptors on its surface, trying to catch any little bit of signal it can. The sources mention this in muscle cells too, but it happens with neurons. It's a compensation mechanism.
Does it work? Like fully compensate?
Usually not for widespread damage, the sources say. It's more of a local adjustment, but it shows the neuron trying to adapt to the loss of input.
Okay. So we've got changes at the synapse level, strengthening, weakening, pruning, becoming super sensitive. What about bigger picture changes?
Yes. Beyond the synapse, the sources talk about larger scale adaptations, especially after injury or major changes in input.
Right.
One really surprising finding, something that totally overturned older ideas, is adult neurogenesis.
Neurogenesis, meaning new neurons
in adult. The generation of brand new functional neurons, even in the adult brain. From stem cells.
Wow. I thought that stopped after childhood.
That was the old thinking. But the sources are clear. It happens. However, big caveat, it seems to occur mainly in restricted areas.
Not everywhere.
No. Notably in the hippocampus, which we know is key for memory, but not generally throughout the whole brain. Still, pretty amazing it happens at all in adults.
Absolutely. What else?
Then there's a concept called equipotentiality.
Equipotentiality.
Yeah. The sources define it as the idea that if part of a neural system is damaged, an intact part of that same system or region might be able to take over the function.
So within the same team, someone else picks up the slack.
Kinda, yes.
Oh.
Keeping the overall system working. They mentioned this came up in early memory research, the idea that memory wasn't just in one tiny spot, but maybe distributed. So if you lost a piece, the rest of the region could still sort of produce the memory or behavior.
Okay. And how is that different from vicariation? I think I saw that term too.
Good question. They're related but distinct. Vicariation is when a different brain area compensates for loss of function in a damaged one.
Ah, so not within the same team, but another team steps up.
Exactly. One brain region basically takes on the job of another one that's damaged or gone.
Okay. Examples.
The sources give some clear ones. After a stroke affecting movement, maybe undamaged motor areas or even other related areas, strengthen connections to try and help regain control.
Makes sense.
or after traumatic brain injury impacting memory, the brain might build new links between different areas involved in learning and memory, trying to compensate.
Right.
With hearing loss, the auditory cortex isn't getting its usual input, right? So the visual cortex might become more involved in processing visual things like sign language or lip reading.
Wow, the visual system helps out hearing.
Or rather, helps compensate for the lack of hearing input by boosting visual processing relevant to communication. And the reverse happens with vision loss areas. Normally, for sight, can get recruited to process touch and sound more acutely.
So equipotentiality is like backup within the department. Vicariation is like another department lending a hand.
That's a pretty good way to think about how the sources describe the difference.
Yes.
Compensation within versus between systems or regions.
Okay. One more term I saw was diaschesis.
Diaschesis. Yes. This one's a bit different. It's defined as a temporary decrease in function.
Temporary. Okay.
In a brain region that's connected to a damaged area, but isn't damaged itself.
So the damage somewhere else causes a temporary shutdown nearby.
Or in a functionally connected area. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a ripple effect. The sources say it's usually temporary and function often recovers. You might see it briefly in connected areas after a stroke or maybe brain surgery or even a concussion.
Why does it happen?
That's the thing. The sources point out the exact mechanisms are still largely a mystery. We know it happens, but not quite why the connected area goes quiet temporarily.
Fascinating. Okay, that gives a really solid picture of the how, LTP, LTD, pruning, neurogenesis, compensation. Now, let's get concrete. The examples. Where do we actually see this plasticity in action?
Right. This is where it gets really tangible. And the sources have some classics. Probably the most famous is the London taxi driver study.
Ah, yes. The knowledge.
Exactly. To get their license, these drivers have to memorize this incredibly complex map of London streets. Just immense spatial navigation.
I can't even imagine.
So researchers compared their brains to control subjects. And they found structural differences. Specifically in the hippocampus.
The memory and navigation area.
Precisely. They found more gray matter volume in the back part, the posterior hippocampus, and actually a bit less volume in the front part, the anterior hippocampus, compared to controls.
More in the back, less in the front. Interesting.
But here's the clincher. The longer they had been driving taxis, the bigger that posterior hippocampus was.
Whoa. So the experience itself was changing their brain structure.
Directly correlated. And these were adults. Remember, not kids whose brains are still rapidly developing. It was a landmark study showing significant adult brain plasticity due to experience.
It's just navigating a city, physically reshaping your brain, that's powerful.
Isn't it? Another great example, learning a second language.
Right, you mentioned that earlier.
Studies show learning a new language is associated with increased gray matter density, specifically in the left inferior parietal cortex.
Okay.
And what the sources highlight is really cool. The density increases with how proficient you become.
So the better you get, the denser that part of your brain.
Seems so. But interestingly, the density tends to be lower the later in life you start learning.
Ah, so learning earlier generally means higher density.
That's what the data suggests. It echoes that idea that plasticity might be, you know, a bit more robust when you're younger, but it definitely still happens significantly in adults.
That makes sense. It often feels easier for kids, but it's great that our brains still change when we learn later.
It is. Now, for a really powerful example of vicariation, that idea of repurposing brain areas, look at studies of people with visual impairments.
Okay.
If someone is visually impaired, especially from birth, their visual cortex isn't getting visual input, right?
Right.
So does it just sit there doing nothing? No. The brain repurposes it.
Repurposes it for what?
For other senses. The sources describe how, in sighted people, synapses in the visual cortex that could process touch or hearing get sort of inhibited by the constant visual signals and eventually pruned.
Uh-huh.
But in someone visually impaired from early on, those pathways for touch, hearing, even smell, they don't get pruned in the same way. They can develop and strengthen within the visual cortex.
So the visual cortex starts processing touch and sound.
Yes. It's called cross-modal plasticity.
Hmm.
One sensory area basically takes on tasks, usually handled by others. And yeah, the sources say this effect is often stronger if the impairment is congenital from birth, presumably because those alternative pathways didn't get pruned by visual input early on.
That's incredible repurposing.
It really is. And you even see hints of this in sighted adults learning Braille. Studies tracked them and found changes, adaptations in their brain's reading network to handle tactile input, changes in gray matter volume. It shows plasticity isn't just for damage, it's fundamental to learning new skills too.
Amazing. Those are great examples of adapting to environment, learning, senses. What about those really dramatic case studies, like after major injury?
Yeah, the sources include some truly compelling individual stories. They really highlight the potential, especially in young brains. There's the case of Cheryl Schultz.
What happened to her?
She lost her sense of balance due to medication damaging her vestibular system. Completely debilitating.
Terrible.
But this device was created. It used a sensor on her head that translated her head movements, her balance information, into tiny electrical pulses.
Okay. Where do the pulses go?
Onto a little strip she held on her tongue.
On her tongue. How would that help balance?
That's the neuroplasticity part.
Yeah.
Her brain, over time, learned to interpret these completely new signals coming from her tongue as balance information.
Yeah.
It integrated this novel sensory input, and she regained her balance.
The brain learned to feel balance through the tongue.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Adapting to a totally new way of getting sensory information. Amazing.
Truly amazing. What else?
Then there's the story of a 6-year-old boy. He had such severe seizures, they had to remove a large part of his right brain hemisphere, including visual areas.
Half his brain, basically, at 6.
A very significant part, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Devastating seizures. But later scans showed his left hemisphere had reorganized. It had taken over many of the visual functions that would normally be handled by the removed right side.
And his abilities?
Surprisingly intact, cognitively. His IQ even reportedly increased slightly after the surgery stopped the seizures. It just shows the immense compensatory power, especially in a young, developing brain.
Unbelievable resilience.
And one more, Maura Lieb. She had a stroke before birth that damaged her left hemisphere, the one usually dominant for language and motor control.
Oh, wow.
At 9 months old, she had a hemispherectomy removal of that damaged left side. But with intensive therapy, her right hemisphere gradually took over. Speech, motor skills, functions normally associated with the left.
So the right side learned to do the left side's job.
Exactly. These cases are extreme, of course, but they are powerful illustrations of just how adaptable the young brain can be, reorganizing after severe injury.
It's hard to wrap your head around that level of recovery and rerouting, especially in kids. Does this mean, is every part of the brain equally plastic? Can any part change like this?
Ah, good question. And according to the sources, no, it's not uniform.
All right.
Plasticity varies quite a bit. Depends on the brain region, depends on the situation. Are we talking normal learning or recovery from damage?
Right.
So for adapting to normal learning, new experiences, the sources suggest regions heavily involved in that processing error are potentially more plastic.
Which ones?
Like the hippocampus, we saw that with the taxi drivers, essential for memory.
Yeah.
The visual cortex, adapting to input. The motor cortex, for learning movements. And the prefrontal cortex, for higher thinking, reasoning, planning. These areas are constantly involved in learning and adapting.
Makes sense. What about recovery from damage? Are those same areas best at recovering?
It's a bit different. The sources suggest the hippocampus and maybe the motor cortex might have a somewhat higher chance of recovery plasticity compared to, say, the visual cortex or prefrontal cortex, especially if the damage is significant.
Why them?
Well, the hippocampus has that adult neurogenesis we talked about,
yeah,
the ability to make new neurons. That could play a role, but again, it's really variable. Depends heavily on the extent of damage, the person's age, lots of factors. It's definitely not guaranteed recovery.
Understood. So which areas are maybe less plastic?
The sources suggest areas like the basal ganglia, involved more in ingrained habits and initiating movement, and maybe the primary auditory cortex do that initial sound processing, might be relatively less plastic.
Meaning
less likely to generate new neurons, perhaps, or undergo the kind of massive, large-scale reorganization we see sometimes in the visual cortex after sensory loss. Their roles might be a bit more fixed, comparatively.
So the brain's ability to change isn't flat. It's more like a landscape with different features. Some areas are more dynamic. Some are better at certain kinds of changes than others.
That's a really good analogy. A very terrain of plasticity.
Okay. Wow. We have covered so much ground in this deep dive.
Yeah.
From the basic idea, the definition, to how it works at the synapse level.
LTP, LTD, pruning.
Right. And then the bigger concepts, new neurons, compensation like equipotentiality and vicariation.
And those temporary shutdowns with dyschisis.
Yeah. And then seeing it all play out in those just mind-boggling real-world examples. The taxi drivers, language learners, the visual cortex repurposing itself as incredible case studies.
It really paints a clear picture. The brain isn't fixed after childhood. Not at all. It's this dynamic, constantly adapting system.
Throughout life.
Throughout life. We saw it works by strengthening connections, weakening others, pruning the unused ones, even making new cells in some places.
And having whole areas step up to compensate when needed.
Exactly. Compensating for lost function, repurposing areas. It's remarkable.
But, as you said, not magic. Powerful. Offers hope for learning, for recovery, but it has limits. It varies.
That's the key takeaway. Powerful but nuanced.
And thinking about your own life, you know, anytime you've learned something really new, maybe a language, an instrument, a complex skill.
Or adapted to a big change, recovered from a challenge.
You've actually been witnessing neuroplasticity, your own brain changing.
You really have. Your brain was physically reorganizing based on those experiences.
Incredible.
And that leads to a final thought, maybe. Building on these sources, given this incredible ability of the brain to adapt, to physically change based on experience, based on stimulation, what does that really suggest about the impact of our environment? Our learning strategies, the challenges we choose to take on, even just the information we feed our brains every day.
How much could that be shaping the actual structure and function of our brains over our lifetime?
Exactly. What's the long-term cumulative effect of all that input and experience on the physical brain itself? It's a pretty profound thought to sit with.
It really is a fantastic place to leave it. Thank you for sharing these incredible sources with us and for taking this deep dive into the truly astonishing world of neuroplasticity.